and welcome to the November series of Lunch and Learns at Zeitmann's. There are sheets out on the table, on the tables. I also put out sign-in sheets, but they're on the front three tables. Please make sure that you sign in to get email about the rest of the sessions. The first email I sent out to the people who have gone to sessions in general, but going forward I send it specifically to people who sign in for this. So if you could maybe use the sheets that are on your table to sign in and then pass them around. In particular, if you want a record for credit for coming, then we need to have your name down. I also intend to send out afterwards a follow-up email on anything that comes up during the session that we don't deal with now, and a link to the audio recording. If for some reason you have a cell phone with you, if you could put it on silent or vibrate, that would be very helpful. I want to thank Reem for putting this together in terms of arranging the food and the copies and so on, and Zeifman's in general for hosting and generously providing lunch, and Jeffrey and Rachel Silver for dedicating this series of lunches in memory of Mr. Meir Zeifman, Zichrono Livracha. The topic that we're going to talk about is professional confidentiality. This is the first of three under the heading of the ethical challenge. And I gave you on your sheet right at the top the three cases that I want to look at, all dealing with confidentiality issues, which I think are of some practical relevance for people dealing in financial services. I tend to use the word accountant, even though I mean financial services professionals in general. Susan is the personal tax accountant for Jane, who is the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. Jane asks Susan for advice regarding her stock options, her RRSP holdings. She's quietly planning to retire in 2 years. Is the news of Jane's pending retirement considered confidential information? So that's one question. Right? Why is this a question? What is it about this fact scenario that makes it a question? In other words, why isn't it obvious one way or the other? Sorry? Well, it's a public company, but that's not... I think fundamentally what makes this a question... Yeah, Moshe.
If her departure is perceived as being something really be adverse to the importance of the company, and all the stock options and everything else can be worth less at that time than for other people as well.
Right. Well, that could be an argument to not make it confidential information,
right,
but for it to be disclosed. But let's say she's not in a state where she's going to be required to disclose this. What makes this an interesting question to me is that this is personal information, but... It's, in other words, personal meaning non-business information. She's planning to retire. She might just as well make a comment to her neighbor that she's looking at retiring. On the other hand, it's disclosed in a professional setting while dealing with business issues. And so the question is, do you know this as an accountant? Do you know this as a friend? And that could determine whether it's going to be viewed as personal and confidential information that cannot be disclosed. Right, so that's actually not true. That's a very important point. I thank you for pointing that out. While it's true that there are separate confidentiality agreements, even in the absence of a confidentiality agreement, you're not allowed to disclose the contents of this. And we'll talk about this. I'm going to show you chapter and verse, so to speak, to that effect. The confidentiality agreement is not necessary in order for there to be a basic requirement for confidentiality. Those may add other elements. But that's number one. The second case we look at, Sam is the personal tax accountant for his neighbor Jim, who is the lead partner in a private business that is going public. Okay, so he takes care of personal taxes for his neighbor who is already a partner in a private business. Business is going public, and based on Jim's personal tax information, it seems he has been secretly and illegally directing funds from the business into his private bank account. He's doing something wrong. Does Sam have a duty to disclose this to any regulatory authorities? May Sam disclose this to his other neighbor who is planning to invest her entire RRSP into the IPO? Right, the first question, does Sam have to go to the regulatory authorities? The answer is... right? The answer is, generally speaking, yes. You do have an obligation to disclose that. But the ability to disclose that to your neighbor, to prevent your neighbor from making a bad investment, that gets even more complicated, right? It's complicated, first of all, because it's your neighbor, it's not a regulatory authority. But it's also complicated because the neighbor didn't ask, right? What are you going to do when the neighbor actually asks you, I know you have a business connection to so-and-so, what do you think? You know, can I invest in this? That's, to me, what makes it an interesting question. The third question is the hardest one of the bunch. And again, for those who are just coming in and sitting down now, make sure, please, that you sign in on the sign-in sheets that are available on the tables. But the third one, Sarah, an accountant, possesses confidential information. Failure to share it with her friend David is likely to cause David unspecified harm. Sarah consults a lawyer who explains she may not share the information. Lawyer tells her, sorry, you're not able to disclose this. But Sarah believes she has a religious obligation to save David from harm. The conflict is, my religion says, talk. However, regulations say, don't talk. Now, what should Sarah do? And that's one that comes up across professions. This comes up in every area. One of the classics that physicians get all the time, unfortunately, is they're asked for information, let's say shidduch-related, right, in terms of a potential marriage. They're asked for information about a patient of theirs. You better believe they're not allowed to disclose that. There are very serious rules against disclosing that. But the person who sits next to them in shul wants to get a little bit of information, maybe to ease their mind. What does the doctor do in a case like that? That's what we're talking about, where someone comes to you expecting information you can't give. Not necessarily, no. Because Lashon Hara is justified, right, in the event that you're saving somebody from harm. And you can come up with all sorts of cases. So, it's a complicated issue, yeah.
So we're proceeding on the basis that she does have a religious obligation to share this information?
Well, by the time we get to the end, we'll have specifics of a case, and then we'll see, because not every case does she have such an obligation. No.
Right.
That's correct. By the time we get to the application of this, we'll have a better idea of where there might be such a duty. So we start out by talking about Canadian society in general, CPA Ontario, and Jewish law, and their approaches to confidentiality. In Canadian society in general, there is a right to privacy, and it is protected by law based on popular convention, based on what people want, essentially. So it's a response to people's preferences. So under federal law, Section 8 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms protects you from search and seizure, which unreasonably invades privacy. The Privacy Act of 1983 says the government has limits on what it can do with your personal data. There was another act in 2008 that limited commercial use of personal data, and now there is a tort called intrusion upon seclusion. The intrusion upon seclusion existed in American law for over a century, but it's relatively new in Canada. But basically it says, if I want my information to be private, you do not have the right to disclose it. That's basically the idea, and it can be prosecuted. That's in terms of general Canadian society. Then we get to the professional responsibility of a financial services professional. Reality is that people who work in this business have access to personal information. Right? Failure to keep the information confidential is going to cause harm both in this specific relationship between the professional and the client, and it's going to cause harm in terms of general confidence in the profession. Right? If there are horror stories about someone whose accountant went and told people about their business, the result is going to be that people won't trust professionals in that business overall. I brought you source number two. Number one is just about the tort of intrusion upon seclusion. But take a look at number two. This was a submission from Chartered Professional Accountants of Ontario when there was a discussion about rewriting some of the rules and whether tighter regulations were needed. And from their document, which is available at the website that I list, they said, taken together, we submit that these principles, which include those of protecting confidentiality, which are elaborated upon in the code and rigorously enforced, impose a, quote, best interests duty upon CPAs in Ontario and elsewhere. We have to look at the best interests of the client and value that above other things in terms of our decision of whether to disclose or not to to disclose. And so confidentiality becomes a fundamental principle. Take a look at number three, please. Chartered professional accountants protect confidential information acquired as a result of professional employment and business relationships and do not disclose it without proper and specific authority, nor do they exploit such information for their personal advantage or the advantage of a third party. Just to clarify,
can't do it,
right? To clarify, this is different from privilege, right? Because this, I see people sometimes mix the two, confidentiality and privilege. Those are two different issues, right? Privilege, well, confidentiality is, I have an obligation to keep this secret except under certain circumstances, such as it's demanded as part of a legal proceeding, where the judge is aware of my confidentiality issues and yet says, nonetheless, this has to be disclosed. What privilege would do would be to say that the judge can't make that demand. Privilege is a protection in a court of law that will say the judge can't demand it. And financial services professionals, as a general rule, don't have that. Meaning lawyers have that. Solicitors have that. But accountants do not have that, except where there is a lawyer involved. Right? You can have a case in which if you were to disclose the information to the court, that would end up violating solicitor-client privilege. But the lawyer personally does not have any such protection. All the lawyer has is the duty for confidentiality. What is that clear? I'm seeing a... No? Not clear. Okay, what confidentiality means is that I, as an accountant, I'm not an accountant, but I, as an accountant, am not allowed to divulge information unless I have, for example, the consent of the person involved, unless it's necessary to perform the duty I'm being asked to perform. I have to fill it out on the CRA form, so that's divulging confidential information, but that's my job. Or in the event that the judge believes in a particular case that there's been a crime committed and orders me to divulge it, and I say to the judge, you know, this is confidential information, and the judge says, I know, now divulge it. So confidentiality stops when the court says, the law says, I have to tell. If I were a lawyer and this were my client, I or the client could come back to the judge and say, you don't have the right to demand this information, this is under solicitor-client privilege, and then there are rules governing what can be done and what can't be done. The accountant can't say that. There's no such thing. That's the privilege distinction, completely separate from what we're talking about in terms of confidentiality. There have been attempts over the years to try to get privilege for accountants. I don't believe any of them have been successful. I understand why you want it, but I don't believe there's been any success in that regard. Broader conversation. It's a good question, but there are specific areas of information which do not need to be disclosed, but offhand I can't speak about specifics. I don't remember enough to be able to talk specifically. Yeah?
Does advantage here include not being hard?
Like meaning?
When it says you can't use the personal information to your advantage.
Correct.
Does that include not being hard?
That's interesting. To avoid being harmed. In other words, the case that I gave before, right? They want to invest in something and they would be harmed by this. That's a good question. I'm not sure. Avoiding a disadvantage, is that viewed in the same way as an advantage? If you follow Zeb's question, you go back to the opening case that I gave. The neighbor wants to invest in a company. It's confidential information that this company is going to one of the lead people involved is engaged in a fraud. Could you disclose it, even if you're not allowed to disclose it for the advantage of a third party, could you disclose it to prevent harm? It's going to sort of come back a little bit. So I may end up addressing this as part of the general harm discussion. So the answer is going to be no, but we'll see as we get there.
Also financial loss. If there's a financial loss, you actually do not have to...
So that's where we're going. But that's where we're going. So the first thing that I want to do, not the first because we've done a couple of things, but the next thing I want to do at any rate is to define confidential information. Right? What constitutes confidential information? So take a look at source number 4 from the CPA Code of Professional Conduct. Confidential information means information acquired in the course of a professional services relationship with a party. Such information is confidential to the party, regardless of the nature or source of the information, or the fact that others may share the knowledge. Even if somebody else knows it, that isn't sufficient for me to say, well, I guess it's not confidential anymore. It doesn't work that way. Such information remains confidential until the party expressly or impliedly, I love that word, impliedly, authorizes it to be divulged. In the case of... The lawyers use the same word. It's a very strange word. In the case of an employee-employer relationship, a member has legal obligations to the employer that include a duty of confidentiality. The CPA Code imposes a duty of confidentiality as a professional obligation in addition to the member's legal obligation to the employer. There's an overall duty to keep information private. If it came about... If it was acquired in the course of a professional services relationship with a party. This is all background, obviously, in terms of what the rules are. I hope that this is, you know, vaguely familiar to people, particularly those who are in the profession. But what was particularly interesting to me about the way this works is the extent of the duties involved in preserving confidentiality. If you had asked me what it means to keep information confidential, I would have answered, I think most people would answer, it means keep your mouth closed. Right? It means don't tell people. But there are actually greater requirements than that involved. Source number 5 is from section 208 of the CPA Code. So the first part of source number 5, a member or firm shall not disclose any confidential information concerning the affairs of any client, former client, employer, or former employer, except when, and then it gives you the exceptions. Number 1, you're carrying out your professional duties. Like I said before, you're filling out the form for the CRA. That's what they told you to do. It's not disclosing confidential information for you to put that down. That would be very interesting if you could take action against your accountant for writing it in on the form. For the CRA. Second, if it should properly be disclosed for purposes of rules 101, 211, or 302. So I'm not going to ask you whether you know offhand what those rules are. 101 is government legislation. 211 is breach of the CPA code. And 302 is a communication with one's predecessor. In those cases, you may be able to, it could be you're supposed to disclose it. Third, if the information is required to be disclosed by order of lawful authority, right? That's the judge we mentioned before, or under the authority of CPA Ontario. Fourth, if you need to defend yourself, member, firm, associates, and so on, against legal proceedings, you're able to disclose it to the extent necessary to defend yourself. And then last, the client, former client, etc., has provided consent to such disclosure. If they say it's okay to tell... So it's okay to tell. So that's part one, which is simply, again, it's keep your mouth closed. Don't say anything. However, I wanted to add a note on this, and that's to take it down to number 6 for a moment, because this goes back to Jeff's question about harm, and it's going to relate to the questions that we have to address, our practical cases. This is from the Chartered Professional Accountants of Ontario Act. Every person engaged in the administration of this act and the bylaws shall preserve secrecy respecting information or material that comes to his or her knowledge or possession in the course of his or her duties under this act, predecessor act, public accounting act, and shall not disclose any such information or material to any person except, and it gives exceptions, and look at exception E. If there are reasonable grounds for believing that there is a significant risk of harm to any person if the disclosure is not made, and that making the disclosure is likely to reduce the risk. A significant risk of harm to any person if the disclosure is not made. Then you're allowed to tell. What's the problem with this clause?
Confidentiality.
Well, that's true, but this is a significant judgment call. Right, significant risk of harm. What is significant risk of harm? Right, I'm going to invest in this company and I'll lose my RRSP. Wow, that sounds like significant risk of harm to me. But really? I mean, imagine what's involved then in practicing as an accountant or any financial service, right? If you're going to be under obligation to disclose any time there's a risk to people because of information that you now have as somebody working for that, right? I mean, you're working for a company, the company's in trouble, but it's you know, information that's private right now, and you have to, you know, take out a billboard somewhere and let everybody know. That's a very dangerous game.
It doesn't say you have to.
So that's one of the big questions we're going to have to ask is this you have to, or is this you have the option to do? But even if you have the option, that means that you're licensed to take out the billboard if you feel like it, right? That's a very dangerous game. Gil.
I don't know much about the Securities Act, but I would imagine there are rules there about insider training and using insider information. So if you are an accountant dealing with a company that's about to go public, but you really have concerns, it looks like if it's going to cause significant risk of harm to any person, you can't disclose. But I would imagine the Securities Act or the case law in the Securities Act is going to say you can't use that confidential information.
Right. See, there are two different sides to this. One side to it is your ability to disclose it. The other side is someone's ability to use it. Which will take you into a whole other realm. But yes, so what we have right now is a statement of don't disclose with certain exceptions, one of the exceptions being to prevent significant risk of harm, which we really need to define better. I brought you another source here because I thought it was worth noting. Take a look at source number 7. This is the Law Society's analogous rule in their rules of professional conduct. It is rare that I will say to somebody, I like the way lawyers draw up their rules. But the truth is, they did a much better job. A lawyer may disclose confidential information, but must not disclose more information than is required when the lawyer believes on reasonable grounds that there is an imminent risk of death or serious bodily harm, and disclosure is necessary to prevent the death or harm. So what did they do that the accountant rule did not? They gave you a definition. Right? They didn't just say significant risk of harm. They distinguished between death and bodily harm and other forms of danger. And in fact, look at the commentary they provide on it, because the rules of professional conduct come with Rashi. The Supreme Court of Canada has considered the meaning of the words, quote, serious bodily harm in certain contexts, which may inform a lawyer in assessing whether disclosure of confidential information is warranted. In Smith v. Jones, the court observed that serious psychological harm may constitute serious bodily harm if it substantially interferes with the health or well-being of the individual. So psychological harm may be included. I look at the rules for accountants and I don't know. I don't know. Significant risk of harm. I don't know what that means.
There's another major difference also.
Yes.
Not disclose more information that's required. That will leave you open.
Correct.
You can do whatever you want.
Correct. The lawyers made sure to say only as needed. And the accounting one, in this part, they did it on some of their other exceptions, but on this, they did not do so. There's more to talk about with this. Note also that for the lawyers, it only says may, so it's explicit that it's optional. The language for the accountants is not so clear. I'm going to come back to that. But that's number one, is don't disclose. Go back now to the top of this page, please, 208.2. The second obligation is, I'm going to, in the interest of time, speed this up a little bit, but the second obligation that you see recorded is not to use confidential information for the advantage of the member or firm, the advantage of a third party, or to the disadvantage of the client or employer. So in other words, it's not just don't disclose it, but don't use it. And then the third part is what we would call in Hebrew, mitzvah saseh, this is your obligation to act in a way that will protect the confidentiality. You have all sorts of measures that are necessary that you have to take in order to keep the information confidential, right? When you get into issues like conflicts of interest and you have firewalls and you have codes of cone of silence and the like, mechanisms to make sure that information doesn't go beyond those who are supposed to be aware of it. So not only do you have don't tell and don't take advantage of, but you also have the active requirement of making sure that you take the steps to keep the information confidential. Clear? Good? Okay. Hopefully, we're satisfying our CPD requirement with all of the lines here. What about in a Jewish law perspective? Is there an obligation of professional confidentiality in halacha? Professional confidentiality. Correct. The answer is no. What there is instead is an obligation of personal confidentiality, which is way broader than anything any profession is ever going to impose. Take a look at source number 8. The Gemara in Yuma notes that Hashem speaks to Moshe and tells him what he wants Moshe to tell the Jews, and he tells him at the end of the sentence, lay more. What does lay more mean? So the truth is, it's a vague word, and there are different instances in which it's used in different ways, but as the Gemara here, as the Talmud here interprets it, the word lay more means go tell it to other people. Hashem said to Moshe, go tell this to the nation. On this, the Gemara says, it's in source number 8, I'm going to read out the English, but I gave you the Hebrew, so that those who have the Hebrew skills can read it. How do we know that one may not repeat something that's told to him until he is told, go tell it? Because the Torah says, and God spoke to him, to Moshe, from the tent of meeting, to go tell. In other words, my default assumption has to be, I am not allowed to tell. Someone tells me any piece of information from a Jewish perspective, ranging from an investment they're making to that their daughter is getting married, I am not allowed to pass along the information without their explicit permission. That's the idea. So much so that if you take a look at source number 9, the Rambam, Maimonides, codifies this. He says, one who swears to another, he swears to somebody, I'm not going to offer the testimony that I possess about you. Right? I have testimony about you, I'm not going to do it, and he swears he won't do it. Or I won't testify regarding you if I do know testimony. So that's called a vain oath. Sorry, what he's doing here is a separate point. What he's saying here is, there will be times when I have to break the confidentiality, such as if a court demands testimony, I will be required to testify, and if you swear that you won't testify, that's just called swearing in vain. So the general rule is that one doesn't tell, but a court may require one to tell. But as noted by Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, the Chafetz Chaim, the rule is that even where you are supposed to tell, it's like what the Law Society said, you can only tell the absolute minimum. That's a basic principle of privacy. It is true that where there is a social convention to tell, one is allowed to do so. There are certain things that are, to borrow the term from before, implied in communication. So for example, God forbid it happens, somebody loses a relative, right? And you find out that the funeral is going to be at 2 o'clock that afternoon. So do you say, well, I can't let everybody know about the funeral because that's confidential information. The answer is no. There are things that are considered to be public based on the way people normally conduct themselves, even if he didn't say to you, go ahead and let people know. But we err on the side of caution. We err on the side of caution with it. So, for example, the Talmud discusses a case in which somebody is very ill, and it says, you're not supposed to disclose that and just let people know. The person may not want people to know about their illness. You think you're doing them a favor, because everybody will know, and they'll look after them, and they'll take care of them. It's not so simple and straightforward. You really do need to seek permission. And there are a few reasons for this. What's the logic behind the Torah's emphasis on confidentiality? What's the logic? So one issue is you want to protect the individuals involved, right? It's simply a matter of protecting them from harm. I brought you in source number 10, Rabbi Yeshua Falk, the Smak, commenting on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Code of Jewish Law. He's dealing with a separate issue. He's dealing with not looking into other people's property. I'm not supposed to look into someone's window. I'm not supposed to look into their yard, right, without their permission. He says, sight itself does not harm. Seeing it isn't doing anything to the property. But it leads to harm because the other person can't go about his business in his yard due to embarrassment. Right? In other words, you're restricting his use of his property. And that that in and of itself is considered harmful because of the shame that I'm going to put on him if he does try to use it. So causing somebody else embarrassment by disclosing it is itself harmful. There's an element of protecting individuals, and that's part of it. Another element, though, is that it protects society as a whole. I brought you from the Sefer HaChinuch, a book that catalogs all of the Torah's mitzvot and gives commentary on each. Source number 11 is at the bottom of one side, continues at the top of the next side with the English. It says, among the roots of this command, and he's talking about the command of Rechilut, not to go around tail-bearing, among the roots of this command is that God desires the good of His creations, and He instructed us in this, so that there should be peace among us, as gossip is cause for quarreling and strife. The meaning, keep things confidential in order to prevent discord among people. And that's a second reason for the Torah's emphasis, is it's better for society in general. Even if telling the information isn't going to hurt him in any way, isn't even going to embarrass him, it's better in society not to have people talking about each other. You're better off that way.
It's interesting that Kumar used the word haver, not then a dumber each, and it could have reached those laws, but it doesn't.
Even though it's a friend.
A bit of a subtle reminder, friend or not, that we're supposed to treat people and interact with them as if they're our friend,
right.
They will be a little more conscious.
Right. Could be. I mean, the word chaver is a versatile word, but it could be that that's a subtle message of, even if it's your friend, that doesn't warrant disclosure. And so that's a second layer here. But then there's a third layer, and the third layer is a religious value. Separate from don't harm people by disclosing their information, and separate from create peace within society by not discussing other people, there's also an element between the human being and God. And I brought you a passage from Micha, one of the prophets from Treyasar. It's source number 12. He says, "Higilcha Adam Matov." God has told you what is good. Uma Hashem Doresh Mimcha, and what God requires of you. What does He want? Do justice, love kindness, and walk privately with your God. Walking privately, the Hebrew term for that is tzniut, is a very broad expectation, but part of it is understood to be an expectation that we will pursue a private life. Not to go broadcasting things to the world. Not as a function of, because broadcasting things hurts people, but just that this is considered to be a virtuous way to live, to not look to share everything with the world. So you end up with these three factors, protecting individuals, protecting society, and as well the virtuous relationship with God, all militating towards keeping information quiet.
Couldn't you say that this is a subset of the words you don't think when you think, you're just talking, but you're not thinking of the consequences.
Right. So for sure, I mean, that's with the Sefer HaChinuch that I brought you in number 11, that's what he's commenting on, is the prohibition of rechilut, of tail-bearing. Absolutely. Now, what you don't have is the added layer of confidentiality for professionals, right? That professional confidentiality does not exist. So why don't you have a stronger layer for professionals? Why don't you have something added for professionals?
It would be redundant.
Would be redundant? You couldn't have come up with something more intense?
You can't do anything as an individual, but why would you be able to do it as a professional?
So here's what I would suggest. What it could have looked like, and they didn't do, would have essentially been privilege. To say that, even in cases where telling is normally justified, don't tell because you have a professional relationship. That's what I would have thought. So I'll give you an example. This was alluded to earlier in the discussion about Lashon Hara. Let's say, from a Jewish law perspective, forget the secular law for now. Jewish law perspective. Someone comes up to me and says, I'm planning to go into business with so-and-so. I want to go into business with Jane. And I don't really know Jane so well. I know that you and Jane used to work together. What can you tell me? Can I trust Jane? Now, I know that Jane actually lost her job with our business for embezzling. It was kept very quiet. She lost her job and she moved on from there. From a Jewish law perspective, I have a duty to protect the next person who asks me this question and to say something that's minimal, but something that will let them know there's something to look into here. From a Jewish law perspective, that will be my duty. I simply have to minimize what I say, but I have to let them know that there's something to investigate.
Civil law, absolutely not.
I'm not in civil law. I'm not in civil law.
The law says clearly you cannot make a comment about the form of...
Understood. So that's where we're going to in case number three. We're not there yet, though. But from a Jewish law perspective, I have to tell. So the question is, why doesn't Jewish law create any level of professional confidentiality which would prohibit me from telling in those circumstances? Right? Why doesn't it keep me from telling in the same way that secular law does? Right? We have professional confidentiality here telling me don't disclose stuff, right? Except serious risk of personal harm, whatever that means, we haven't defined yet. Why don't I have a similar thing in Jewish law? This is a very important point, I think. Of course there is. Anytime I have a professional arrangement with someone, you hired me to do a job, right? Now we have a professional relationship. That's what I mean by professional. Why isn't there any sort of limitation like that in Judaism, the way that you're seeing here in the CPA code?
Because we have to make our own assessment of a person and give them the benefit of the doubt, starting off just on a more mental kind of way.
So you think it's left to us to have that flexibility? Could be.
Do you consider that the professional is a shaliach? A shaliach to the Torah. So obviously, by extension, you won't be allowed to say something that the individual himself would say.
So the suggestion is that you're an agent on behalf of the person you are working, and therefore you can't say anything they wouldn't say? It's clever. I think I would go in terms of a broader debate that exists between Jewish law and professional practice in general, which is, or not professional practice, but secular law, certainly, in Ontario. There's something in Jewish law called the duty to rescue, right? You have an obligation to help other people and to save them from harm. And it goes on two levels. On one level, I brought you in source number 13, the Torah says, you are not allowed to put a stumbling block in front of the blind. Lifnei iver lo sitein michshol. Don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind, on which the rabbis comment, it's not literally about the blind. If someone is blind in a given matter, if someone asks your advice, don't give them improper advice, which the rabbis have explained to me, not only don't actively mislead somebody, but also, if you see someone is being misled, you have a duty to correct things. This is all part of not letting people part of not putting the stumbling block there is not letting people stumble. The clearest statement of this is the Torah statement, Lo sa'amod al dam re'echa, don't stand by while someone's blood is shed. I brought it for you in source number 14, in which the Talmud says specifically, somebody is drowning in a river, being dragged by an animal, beset by bandits. You have to act to save that person. There is a duty to rescue. Ontario does not have a duty to rescue. In Ontario, unless I have a special relationship with somebody, I'm their doctor, I'm a teacher, something like that, I have no obligation whatsoever. I'm driving down the highway, and I see somebody holding a gun pointed at somebody else, and I don't call 911, I didn't break any laws. There is nothing that obligates me in Ontario law. In Jewish law, I'm in trouble. I violated Lo Samad Al Dam Reyecha. I violated the law that obligates me to act. Yeah?
Well, Al Samad Al Dam Reyecha, does it also include, like, financial ruin?
So look at the three cases. Excellent question. I was going to come back to it, but I'll point it out now since you asked. In source number 14, the three cases were drowning in a river and dragged by a beast. Those are physical harm. Beset by bandits, they're going to steal his property. It's even financial harm is usually the way it's taken. I'm going to come back to it to clarify it further, but that's the general assumption. So what we're saying here is that I have a duty to rescue. Therefore, in Judaism, it's binary. Either you're not allowed to tell, because this is confidential information and you're not supposed to share it, or you are required to tell in order to save somebody from harm. There is no gray area in between. And therefore, you can't impose professional confidentiality because you'd be taking something that I'm supposed to say in order to rescue somebody from harm and rendering it off limits. Whereas, in Ontario, there is no such thing as a duty to rescue. Therefore, it's fine to say, look, professional confidentiality, you're not allowed to tell. And even though it has the exception where it says that in a case of significant harm, you are going to be licensed to tell, right? The Law Society has it, and the CPAs have it as well. It's not presented as an obligation. You may, because there is no duty to rescue. That's the idea. Why they have the exception at all is an interesting question, but it's beyond the scope of what we're going to discuss right now. So on this basis, based on what we've just said, it sounds like, and this is the last bit before we get into the specific cases, it sounds like, if I stop here, the Accounting Society, right, or CPA Ontario, whatever term you want to put on it, is going to tell me that when it comes to rescuing others, other than the case of the significant harm, you're out of luck, you can't tell. And Jewish law is going to insist that you do tell. However, Rabbi Alfred Cohn wrote an article a couple of decades ago, it was 1981, in which he noted, maybe not. Maybe in Judaism you might also recognize an element of professional confidentiality by arguing for the benefit of society. That was his argument. He said, he pointed to a source that I brought you here in source number 15. If people are taken hostage and you want to redeem them, but you're going to have to pay an exorbitant sum, the rule is you're not supposed to pay the exorbitant sum. Why? What's the rationale?
Because you're setting a precedent.
Yeah. You're setting a precedent, and now they're just going to kidnap more people, right? That's what's going to happen. So don't rescue an individual if that's going to endanger society. Even though this individual is going to lose out, nonetheless, you're not allowed to endanger society for the sake of the individual. So argues Rabbi Cohn, it could be the same thing is true regarding the confidentiality issue. Even if by not telling, I am exposing my neighbor to harm, if I do tell, I'm damaging society because now people won't trust their financial services professionals. Right? Or in his case, he was dealing with lawyers. People won't trust the lawyers anymore because they know, well, they disclose my information when they feel it's going to help somebody. So maybe the argument could be made, and that's the argument that Rabbi Cohn tries to put forth, that since society relies on a system in which clients can speak openly with their accountants, maybe that will override the harm to an individual, and therefore there should be some element of professional confidentiality in Judaism as well for the good of society. So what we've seen now, to summarize everything we've said, is, number one, CPA Ontario imposes a duty of taking active steps to protect information aside from not disclosing. Which is very interesting because I don't think in Judaism you have the same level of requirement. I think in this case CPA Ontario requires more than Judaism does by saying you have to take active steps to avoid disclosure. Number two, in Canada and in CPA Ontario, this is fundamentally about the expectations of the public. They want their information private, therefore keep it private. In Judaism it has a religious element as well, which we're going to come back to in case number three clearly. And then the third point of summary is that CPA Ontario has a layer of confidentiality about protecting the specific client and the profession. Judaism seems not to have that because you have the duty to rescue instead. But it's possible to argue, as Rabbi Cohn argues, that maybe Judaism would recognize the need to protect society by not telling in order to preserve overall confidence in the profession. Are we clear so far? Before he gets to the particular cases, Jeffrey.
What Rabbi Cohn was arguing, do you have that today when it comes to Shul rabbis? But that's being recognized now that...
As a source for confidentiality? In other words, the argument would be that they could keep quiet about something that even though disclosure would damage someone. It's an interesting question. I don't know. It's a good question. Let me think on that one. So... Let's go back to our cases now. Our first question revolves around the issue of what constitutes confidential information. Susan is the tax accountant. Susan has information about Jane, the CEO of the Fortune 500 company, that Jane is quietly planning to retire. The information was acquired in the course of a private professional consultation, but the information of itself is not business information in the sense of about the firm. It's she planning to move to the Bahamas. So the question now is, does that constitute confidential information? From a Jewish law perspective, the answer is, yeah, of course this is confidential. You're not allowed to tell anything. Why should you be able to say anything about this? What about from the CPA code's perspective? Sorry? Well, it is confidential information acquired as a result of professional employment and business relationships. Right? So it seems like it is confidential information. It's not directly business information, except that it is, because you're retiring from your business. It's going to impact those who want to invest in the company. So I really like the Law Society's framing in source number 16. The way the Law Society defines it is very clear. This is confidential. A lawyer at all times shall hold in strict confidence all information concerning the business and affairs of the client acquired in the course of the professional relationship. Everything. Simple and straightforward. I like that formulation much more. It's a very it's a very clear expression of it. But I do think that fundamentally I would go back to what we said in source number 2, where it's fundamentally about the best interests of the client. You're violating the best interest of the client if you disclose this, therefore you can't disclose it. What about our second case? Disclosure to prevent financial harm to the neighbor who's planning to invest. Financial harm. So in Judaism, where it's physical harm, it's very clear. Of course you tell. Beginning, middle, and end, and it's very straightforward. In source number 17, I'm talking about somebody who has a driver's license, and they start developing seizures. And Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg was asked the question towards the end of the 20th century of, do I divulge that to the authorities? And the answer is, you bet. If you know somebody has a seizure problem and they're still driving, you had better disclose it to the authorities. He says, you're obligated to do so. It's duty to rescue. The question is, what about financial harm? So I already noted for you the case of bandits. Right? It seems like financial harm is included. Maimonides seems to say that in source number 18, the Rambam in his collection of the mitzvot writes, talking about saving people, if you see that somebody is in danger of death or loss, and we are capable of rescue. The truth of the matter is there's some debate, because some of his language elsewhere is not quite as clear that financial is included. But in general, that's the tendency in Jewish law, is to assume that financial harm is included. That's what the Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, wrote. Jewish law, it seems, will require disclosure to prevent financial harm, like in the embezzling case that I gave before. The only way around it would be if you took Rabbi Alfred Cohn's argument and said, yeah, but for the good of society, it should be kept quiet. What about this the CPA law, right, that just said significant risk of harm? Does that include financial harm? Yes, really? Entirely unclear. I think it's entirely unclear. The Law Society's rule is so much better formed in this sense, in terms of actually providing details about this. It's very, very unclear whether financial harm is included or is not included.
I disagree.
Yeah?
It's very clear, because all the accountant's dealing with is financial. So of course it pertains to him. They're dealing with financial, that's what the accountant does.
Right.
The first thing you would think, when this thing applies only to financial.
That's a really interesting point. I hadn't thought of that. The motion makes the point that if you're talking about a financial services professional disclosing information and saying he can disclose to prevent harm, what other type of harm do you mean besides financial harm? That's a very interesting point. I mean, I can come up with a case where you become aware that they're funding terrorism and in a certain location and someone wants to take a vacation there. But you're right. The standard case really should be financial. But
shouldn't Sam resign because he's dealing with
the... Right. So this is a whole other can of worms. Meaning, you become aware that your client is involved in something inappropriate, in a fraud. What is your duty in terms of informing people and in terms of your own continued employment, you're not allowed to be involved in furthering furthering criminal activity. So it'll depend to a certain extent on the structure of the business that you're working for, or in the case of the personal taxes, it's a little more clear. But yes, he may well end up resigning, but he's taking the information with him. Right?
And then the new accountant's going to ask him why he's resigned, so you're in a bind.
Well, he's going to have to tell. In the predecessor case, that was one of the exceptions that we mentioned earlier, right? That was Section 302, Rule 302, communication with predecessor. He may well end up needing to disclose it to the next person down the line. That may well happen.
He doesn't have to give full disclosure. He just says
minimum. No, he has to give minimum necessary in order to convey what the issue is. But I think you run into a problem if you include financial harm, right? Precisely for the same point that Moshe made, right? He made the point that what other type of harm is there when you're dealing with financial services? But I mean, everything you do is going to be jeopardized by this requirement to inform. You're working for a company, and the company has something go wrong in it. Do you now have a duty to disclose to other people? This becomes really, really difficult to, you know, that's number one, it's very difficult. Number two, realistically, it's a recognized cost of doing business to a certain extent, meaning no one goes into business thinking they know everything that's involved. If I invest in a public company, I expect that I know the things that are supposed to be filed publicly. I don't expect that I know all the ins and outs that are not required to be filed publicly. You know that when you go into business. We've talked about this before when it came to hiding information in any transaction. There are things a seller must tell. There are things a prospective employee must tell. But then there are things that they're allowed to keep private, and everybody in the business knows that they're kept private. So I'm inclined to think that most forms of financial harm would not, would not be disclosed. That's my assumption. The Law Society, that decision has been made that way. That they do not believe that financial harm counts. It's been discussed and bandied for years back and forth. But generally the assumption is you may not disclose for financial harm. I think fundamentally the way that the CPA rules are written is common sense oriented, and it's meant to be implemented in that way. And it would seem that in most cases you wouldn't be able to. But I will add a key note, which is the CPA code allows for a consultation with experts. Meaning, it's not called disclosing confidential information if you go to a lawyer and ask, tell me whether I can tell this or not, and that's what's advised. In a case where you're not sure, so you get somebody to tell you whether you're allowed to tell or not. But that brings me to our last case. And that is, what do I do if it is a case of financial harm? And we follow this view that's in source number 18 that you're supposed to tell in order to prevent financial harm. And I go get my legal consultation, and the lawyer tells me, no, the CPA code will not allow you to tell. What in the world do you do? So there is a principle in Judaism of dina d'malchuta dina. The law of the land is the law. However, that may not really help me here for two reasons. Number one, the law of the land is directly against my Torah obligation of rescuing people. Number two, it's not so clear that the rules of an independent regulatory body count as the law of the land. The law of the land is the law of the government, not necessarily the society I chose to join. So it's not so clear that the law of the land, that type of power is going to exist. Or Michael Broyd notes that in his book, The Pursuit of Justice in Jewish Law, that the industry regulations may not have the status of law of the land. So I really may be expected to tell from a Jewish law perspective. And if you'll tell me, well, what about the confidentiality rights of the other party, I may say, you know, we view him as an attacker. He's harming this other person, and therefore he doesn't have the right to that confidentiality. Nonetheless, it's still unclear to me. And I say that for two reasons. Number one, the point that Rabbi Cohen made about the welfare of society. But number two, because as a general principle, we don't make someone lose money in order to save somebody else's assets. In other words, if somebody else is going to lose something and I'm going to be required to spend in order to save them, it's not so clear that I'm obligated to do so. if you could be censured or could even lose your ability to practice professionally because you told, you may not be obligated to go to that extent and disclose the information. So therefore, it's not so clear to me that one will be obligated to follow the Jewish law requirement in this. I would definitely say consult your shul rabbi in order to get an answer on that. But I hope we've established here the extent of confidentiality within the general obligations of of the CPA code, CPA Ontario, as well as within halacha and Jewish law and the differences between them, and a little bit about some applications to the cases at hand. Please make sure you signed in, both in order to get information about the rest of the series, and especially if you're going to want credit, I need to be able to verify that you were here. I'll stick around for a few minutes if people want to discuss further. Thank you very much. Oh, and since Larry.